Hallo und herzlich willkommen bei Hoffnung ist keine Strategie. Heute gibt es eine ganz besondere Folge. Jürgen, wir haben quasi 3 Jahre darauf hingearbeitet und darauf gewartet.
Ne? So ist es, aber heute passiert es.
Absolut. Heute haben wir zu Gast Willy Peterson. Einer unserer, ich würde mal sagen, auch Geburtsväter des Strategy Frame, der geistige Vater, der uns da auch sehr stark inspiriert hat.
Definitiv. Von ihm haben wir ganz viel über Strategie gelernt und wir freuen uns auf eine inspirierende Session mit ihm.
Absolut. Es geht auch gleich sofort los. Vielleicht ein ganz kurzer Background für euch. Wer ist Willy Peterson? Willy ist in Südafrika geboren, zu Zeiten der Apartheid, hat zuerst als Lawyer gearbeitet, also als Rechtsanwalt, und ist danach in die Corporate-Karriere eingestiegen. War CEO vieler Multi-Major-Companies wie Tropicana, Seagram USA oder Lever Brothers und unterwegs für Unilever. Heute lehrt Willy seit 24 Jahren an der Columbia Business School als Professor of Management Practice und hat unter anderem Bücher geschrieben wie Reinventing Strategy, Strategic Learning und jetzt aktuell sein neuestes Buch Leadership, The Inside Story. Ich wünsche euch viel Spaß. Welcome to Hope is Not a Strategy, the podcast that explores real stories of strategy and leadership. My name is Christian Underwood.
And my name is Jürgen Weigand.
And today, I'm very proud, Jürgen, that we have here with us and welcome Willy Peterson, Professor of Management of Practice at Columbia Business School, and let's say the intellectual father of our very own strategy frame and the book Hope is Not a Strategy. So, Willy, welcome to you from, I think you're sitting in New York, is that right? And you have a book.
Yes, come on. I'm sitting in New York. Your book is next to me here. And it's a nice sunny fall day here.
Yes, now we lost him. Ah, Willy, now you're back.
I'm back. Sorry, did I disappear?
Yeah. Yeah, we just saw the book, so thank you very much for showing it to the audience. So welcome to the podcast, Willy.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we're very pleased to have you, of course. And as Christian said, we owe you a lot of conceptual insights and experiences you shared with us in the classroom. Let me start with a question about what you personally have learned from your career, your outstanding career as a CEO, and how you have translated that into something people like us can use in their strategy making process.
Thank you for that question, Jürgen. Yeah, you know, there are a number of things one can pick out from a long experience like this, but a few of them stand out very strongly. I'm just going to change my glasses here. And the one that I think predominates in my mind is that leadership is mainly about people. Management is about things. It's about projects. It's about getting things done. And it's important, of course. But at the end of the day, leadership is about people. Now, you folk have your leadership or strategy frame. I have strategic learning. We both approach this whole idea of developing winning strategies, which is crucial for organizational success, particularly in a changing world. We have to navigate this and adapt to change constantly, and we have to have a methodology. Now, what I've noticed is in doing many, many workshops and strategy projects with organizations, as you have done as well, that the success of the application of these methods comes right down to leadership. Now, I've noticed that when it works well, because I sometimes get asked, oh, well, does your method always work? Well, no, of course not. It's not a magic bullet. At the end of the day, I point out to people, it works if you make it work. You are the magic bullet. It's people at the end of the day that make these things work. Yeah. And that's a big lesson for me because we tend to get detached from that idea and think about strategy and leadership as a game of chess, a kind of a detached analytical intellectual exercise, right? Outsmarting competition and so on. Well, of course, that's important. And then we need to have a clear, compelling, winning strategy. From that moment on, actually the development of it is also a leadership challenge, but then the leadership challenge clicks into gear in a very strong way when it comes down to implementation. People make work happen. Yeah. And that for me is a big lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. And in your most recent book on leadership, The Inside Story, you emphasize the invisible elements of leadership. What sets this approach apart from traditional leadership models beside the people aspect?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to on the invisible aspects of it, but I do have a framework in mind. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what you're alluding to there, Christian.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Everybody who's in the business world and organizational world and national politics, whatever it is striving to be a better leader. And it's a really interesting conversation to have with people in a seminar, right? You know, what are the hallmarks of great leadership? And how do we improve as leaders? Now, anything we want to do and improve on, whether it's carpentry or any other enterprise, you need to have an underlying concept of what it is, because you know the outputs that you want. You want to inspire people. You want to direct them in a way that leads to a winning game for the organization. Those are the outputs. But what are the inputs? How do we begin to think about a framework that we can hold on to so we can develop our own leadership capabilities in a very conscious, deliberate way and use this as a way to get feedback? So I've got this Venn diagram that for me explains the essential components of leadership. It has three dimensions. First dimension is leadership of self, you know, deep self-knowledge, the establishment of a clear set of principles and values that govern our actions and inspire others and provides transparency and authenticity. That's the first domain. That's permission to lead. The second domain is strategic leadership, the ability to set a clear direction, a winning way, and clear set of priorities. That's domain number two. Domain number three is bringing out the best in others, interpersonal leadership. Now, these three domains are interlinked. And whenever I deal with strategy, you know, the personal and interpersonal aspects of leadership always come into play. Because none of these three can work in isolation. They are mutually interdependent elements. Now, I find that useful because it gives us a practical construct that says, I want to think about my leadership effectiveness. How do I think about it? How do I develop my personal, my strategic, my interpersonal leadership? So that's a kind of, as Voltaire said, cultivate your own garden. Keep learning in terms of getting better. It also, I find, is a better way of getting coaching from others. I'm sure you folk do a lot of coaching. Instead of just saying, how am I doing, which is a too big a question to be useful to people, it's much better to say, look, I've got these three factors in mind. I want to be an integrated leader, bringing them all together synergistically. How am I doing on personal leadership? Am I clear? Am I authentic? Are my values obvious to people? Do I apply them consistently? Second, strategic leadership, same set of questions. Am I setting a clear direction? Are the priorities simple and clear? And then interpersonal. Do I have the ability to really inspire and not just ask for compliance, but really get commitment from the entire organization? Then you get useful feedback because there's a practical construct to help people do that for you productively. So I find that to be a really useful way of thinking about leadership. Now, others could have different models that they use. It's fine as long as they're useful to you. But I tend to have evidence-based points of view about this. So I've thought about it deeply and I've looked at alternative models and this one works for me.
Okay, well, let me pick up on that one. I fully agree and sign your model, the three dimensions you basically just explained. What I have found difficult over the past many years, I've been talking to board members, CEOs, CFOs, and so on. They also would sign that, say, well, this sounds really interesting. This is good. This is exactly what you need. But when it comes to personal leadership and what you said, going deeper into who you are as a person, most people I have met shy away from that. It gets personal, yes. And they are maybe afraid of wakening up something that comes from their past or whatever. So they basically say, maybe it's also some kind of a German cultural thing. This is too esoteric. I don't want to touch on that. Yes, we can talk about leading others, interrelated leadership, but personal things are personal. I don't want to work on that one. What do you think about these people?
I think we have to give people an easy journey to get there. And it's a question of how we frame the challenge. If you say, well, what are your most deeply held convictions and personal preferences in life or something? Oh, that's very personal. That's up to me. I don't know. I'm not an introspective person. Now, if you approach it a little bit differently, and just say, you know, let's talk about your lifeline. Where were you born? Where do you go to college? Where do you go to school? Did you play sport? Tell me some of the experiences that really formed your view, your worldview of life. Some people might say, well, I had a car accident and I recovered from this and I realized what is important is to hold a positive view of the future. And say, oh, well, that sounds like something you believe in a great deal. Now, tell that story with these little pivotal experiences in life and write them down for yourself. Because whether you know it or not, these things sit inside you subconsciously. They do trigger your behavior, whether you're conscious of that or not. They form your worldview, your political view even. We're all a product of our past, of our experiences. Now, the trick is to write these things down. The next thing is to say, well, you know, it's really useful when you write these things down, make them explicit, because you've got then a sort of, you know, what Marcus Aurelius called your command center, which I love that phrase. You know, I'm a great fan of studying philosophy. And we all have an internal command center. Make it explicit, because it's important that others see it. And when it's explicit to you and you act consistently on it, that gives you authenticity. So it's not just about psychoanalysis. It's just about being a human being and being clear about who you really are.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I think back to the times you taught me strategy, I remember reading your book, Reinventing Strategy. Now, I think this is still very modern today. So what is it that we have to reinvent in terms of strategy in our today's environment?
Jürgen, may I correct you? Very respectfully.
Yes.
I did not teach you strategy. We helped each other think about strategy. It's a two-way street. It always is. So, but thank you for being generous in your. So I think of the new challenges. You know, we've got a methodology, and you always have to ask, is it fit for purpose? You have the strategy frame, I have strategic learning. They are kind of brothers.
Yep.
And we're always faced with new challenges. So the idea of this approach that we both share is to be able to constantly refresh and renew our strategy in the face of changing circumstances. Sometimes those circumstances are, you know, mild changes, but they accumulate over time. And other occasions we have big disruptions. And we have to ask ourselves whether our methodology is fit for purpose. Do we need to adjust it in some way? Now, the biggest one, I don't know whether you share this view, but the biggest one today that I observe is artificial intelligence. And I ask myself, how is the process that I'm offering useful to people in finding pathways to apply AI productively in their businesses? Now, the way I've thought about it, and I'd love to hear your perspectives on it, is to remind people, which we both do in our strategy work, that all of these developments like AI are not benefits in and of themselves. They are a means to an end. They are delivery mechanisms to deliver benefits. So always start with the benefits. Then work backwards to say, I've got this powerful tool. How can I use it to deliver these benefits? Now, that, I think, fits quite well with this idea of learning and adapting as the environment changes. I had an experience, I might have mentioned to you, I teach a five-day course every year for physicians of every discipline in a hospital system in New York. And so the most recent session, we began to open up on the application of AI. And three things came into prominence. But it forced us to look at them in a kind of, how can we apply AI as a tool to help us deliver those benefits? Outside-in thinking. And the three that came into prominence, number one, is universal electronic medical records. It's very inefficient now. You go to a different doctor in a different town. Who are you? Fill in the paperwork. We don't know, what medications are you taking. That's possible with AI now. And even maybe globally one day. So that's at the kind of the denominator. Now, in the numerator that drives, revenue, et cetera, you've got two that we identified. And the first is, what clinical trials are happening around the world that are tackling diseases that are important that we're struggling with? How do we get to summarize them quickly? It takes human beings months to study this. What's going on in Romania, Rwanda, wherever the case might be? AI can pull all that together in a matter of hours. The second is I ask them, how many of you have come across rare diseases that you'd never seen before? But you know somebody in the world has seen those diseases, and you say, I wish I knew who they were. AI can discover that. So we get better at solving problems on rare diseases, understanding what's happening in clinical trials. So there are three possible benefits. Now, there might be others in healthcare, but we came across those. It's a reminder that this is a learning system that we have. Strategic learning, your strategy frame is a learning system. And now we begin to explore and how we can learn our way towards success on each of these. We need the expertise in-house to be able to create the AI infrastructure to deliver those benefits. The trap for me in AI is that we think too big. And we've got these large language models, and we say, oh, well, you can do a poem for me in Portuguese. You know, it's a play thing. It's much better to go very, very focused and say, what are the major problems we seeking to solve in a competitive world? And then to develop very sharp tools to do that. So for me, this is one of the big challenges that comes to the fore. There are scarce resources in terms of skills and know-how to be able to do that, for example, in healthcare and in other areas that we both deal with. And that's really become a critical issue, how to train people to be able to create those powerful, very, very focused programmatic tools in AI.
Yeah, thank you, Willie. And today you're training people and you're shaping really learning experience for leadership and strategy, I think now since 24 years at Columbia around. So.
Yes. Yeah, time marches on.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's your third career, as I learned. So your second career was being a CEO around the world for really global businesses like Tropicana, Seagram USA, and Lever Brothers. And from that experience, what you've learned there in really facing high-pressure situation? Because not only today, the world is really volatile. So you may have had these experiences in the past. And could you share some special experiences, some personal stories that shaped your current thinking on leadership and strategy?
Yeah, you know, often people say that being a CEO is a lonely job. Mm-hmm. I think it shouldn't be a lonely job because it's a team sport. So when we confront major problems, don't sit in a room by yourself and say, I'm all powerful, I should know it all, the organization expects me to be a kind of a hero CEO to try and solve it. Diverse perspectives produce much better decisions than experts thinking alone in any event. So, introduce diverse perspectives and think about it that way and then make a decision. And a couple of things about decision-making that I learned along the way. The first one is there's no such thing as a non-decision. Inaction produces its own consequences. And sometimes those are even more dramatic than making a proactive decision. Don't let matters fester. You'll never have perfect information. if you've got about 75% of what you'd ideally like to know, you're doing pretty well. And the remaining 25% is what you paid for. Now, I'm not talking about neurosurgery or rocket science. There you need more than 75%. But there's never 100%. Decision-making is risk-taking. And you've got to understand that. You've got to have courage to do this in the face of uncertainty. The other thing I learned from the Army War College, where I often run seminars, is when you think about making decisions, and these are often tough ones that come onto our desk as senior people, because the easy ones have been solved before, is the way to think about its decision is that assumptions drive decisions. So first of all, ask yourself, what assumptions need to be true for this decision to be a good one? It's always the underlying, don't make those assumptions silent. Make them clear and obvious. Those are some of the elements of decision-making that I learned. Don't let things fester. No such thing as a non-decision. Understand that assumptions drive decisions. And learn from mistakes. The Army War College taught me this thing as well. I mean, bearing mistakes is terrible because you never learn from them. Admit them when they've been made, because when you hide them, you can't learn from them. So what I tried to teach the organizations that I led was that we're all going to make mistakes. We're all imperfect. But the big thing is to make sure that the value of the learning is greater than the cost of the mistake. So when we make mistakes, the first thing to do is to say, I acknowledge this was a mistake. Now, I'm not going to blame you. I'll only blame you if you refuse to learn from it. That's what I blame. I don't blame the mistake. I blame the refusal to learn. So when we learn from it in that kind of way, we get better all the time. Those are some of the lessons I've learned. And the other one is tell the truth. You know, we have this thing, I think, as senior executives, that we can deal with unpleasant realities, but junior people can't. That's terribly arrogant. Now, maybe they can deal with it just as well or even better than we can. So when there are prospects of the company being sold or reorganized, or plant closures are going to happen, be upfront. Tell people upfront. They're going to hear about it anyway through rumor. The rumor will distort the truth, and then you're on the defensive. So over and over again, I learned that lesson of just tell the truth.
Absolutely. And coming to that plant closure, I heard that story from you where you've been personally in that situation. Could you share that a little bit with us?
Yes, yeah, certainly. Thanks for remembering that one. This was in my days at Lever Brothers, and I was sent by Unilever here to the United States to do a turnaround of the foods business in the USA, which was losing a lot of money in the biggest market in the world. And Unilever wanted to turn this business around and turn it into profit. Well, it was a very tough task. And one of the things that became necessary, and that was clear, is that we needed to close some plants and consolidate manufacturing and distribution in a new, more efficient way. One of the plants was in Chicago, in Hammond, just south of Chicago. And I had just recently arrived in the U.S., and I was warned. I went on plant visits, and I visited Hammond, and I was told, oh, boy, it's a rough area. Be careful, you know. We determined that that plant needed to be closed. It was just a hopeless case and a very clear-cut decision to be made. Now, I got advice, strong advice, from my head of operations, a guy called Martin Van Buren. And Martin said, you know, I think we should wait until about 3 months before the closure, before telling, because this was about a year out. He said, don't tell them now because, you know, productivity will go down. They'll be angry and resentful, and you shouldn't do that. I thought about that for a while. I remember sitting in my little home office and brooding about it overnight. And I thought, you know, number one, that's not fair. They need to plan their lives like anybody else. Secondly, they're going to hear about it anyway through the grapevine because that's the way things happen. And then when they do and you finally admit it, they're going to say, well, you didn't tell us in the first place, so now we don't trust anything you're going to tell us now. And then you're really in trouble and your credibility is gone. So I said to Martin, look, let's go and tell them. He said, well, you know, yeah, okay, I'll go. I said, no, I'm going. And you come with me. I need to tell them myself. And we devised a plan of bonuses for maintaining productivity, outplacement services for them so we could help them find new roles, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I was pretty nervous. It was not a nice thing to do. We went between the shifts, et cetera. People realized it was a big announcement, so they were really anxious and they were kind of staring at me. What are you going to tell us? I remember standing on a box and I told them. I said, I'm sorry to have to tell you this. I wish I didn't have to tell you this. Here's the reason we have to close the plant. It's for the greater good. And often when we do things for the greater good, some people are disadvantaged. In this case, it's you. Now, my job is, number one, to tell you the truth. Number two, to describe the bonus system and the outplacement and to ease your journey. The only thing I can do is make your journey easier for you. You've got families, you've got life planning to do, etc. And I said, well, hopefully we can maintain our productivity in this remaining year until the closure. And that's up to you. You've got a great deal of skills. Now, I went back regularly, and the productivity rose to the highest level it had been in 5 years. It didn't just stay where it was. It rose. It went up. The mood in that place was upbeat. People were supporting each other in little circles of discussion and so on. And on one of the visits, I spoke to the head of the union, a very big, imposing man. And I said, I'm just so filled with, I'm astonished and I'm filled with admiration. I said, you know, how come this is happening? The productivity is actually going up. And he said, it's pride, sir. Now, that was a big lesson for me. Now, there's one thing I left out of the story that I want to loop back on. When I finished my presentation to these people in the plant, there were about 200 of them, there was applause. And I thought, what's going on? They misunderstood me. I said to Martin, I've just told them terrible news that they're going to lose their job, and they're applauding me. I said, what's going on? I was kind of whispering to him. And he said, I think they're probably applauding our honesty. And whether people clap their hands or just feel an emotion, they always will applaud your honesty.
Willie, I fully agree with that. But still, how do you, at some point you have to take really tough decisions. Even if people value that you are honest, you still have to send them home. Now, what is that kind of personal feeling that arises when you have to do something like that?
My own personal feelings?
Yes.
Jürgen, you probably are aware I'm a great fan of philosophy. That's really guided my thinking a great deal. And the reason that I admire all the ancient philosophers, the Eastern sages, Roman, Greek, you know, even the so-called Enlightenment philosophers, etc., is the philosophy helps us answer three questions in life. That's my distillation. That's why I enjoy reading it. What's true? What's important? And what's right? And I think that's, you know, as we drive through our, go through our lives, both in personal decisions and in corporate decisions or within academia, we're always confronted with issues of what's true. Truth is elusive because there's a lot of data, and interpretation becomes the king. Finding the truth in the data is a matter of interpretation. So what's true is difficult. Now, amongst all the things that are true, A lot of things are unimportant. Discriminating the important from the unimportant becomes the issue. So what's important? Thirdly is what's right. So it's interesting to me how these three things work together. Because in tough decisions, it's emotional. Inevitably, because we're social animals, we feel empathy. If we've got a healthy psyche, we feel empathy. And sympathy also for what people have to go through. Some of those people in that plant, I learned afterwards, were battling cancer. And now they were losing their jobs and their concerns about maintaining their health insurance. And you hear these stories and respond to them. So, you know, obviously there are human feelings around. Now, if I look at those three questions, if you go through that process in this example we've just discussed, what's true? Well, you know, we're clear that needs, the plant needs to be closed. Now, what's important is the way you deal with the people in it. And now we say, well, what's right? Should I withhold the decision until the last minute? Should I tell them now to give them more time to organize their own lives? Now, this is a choice between right and right. The choices between right and wrong are very easy. We can give those to our teenage kids. The choices between right and right are the hard ones. And then we loop back to what's important. So that's the way I try and figure it out. And what I try and do is to say, emotions can be healthy, but at the extreme, they become unhealthy. Mm. So manage my own emotions, recognize these feelings. And a part of them was nervousness. I felt nervous delivering that. I was told I did not appear to be nervous, but I did feel it because, you know, that anxiety about doing this, I thought maybe they're going to throw things at me. I mean, safety-wise, et cetera, and get a really bad reaction that's hard to handle. These are natural things. I mean, we just have to deal with them, make sure we understand what's true, do what's important, and understand as best you can what's right. And we're always a little bit imperfect. Nobody's perfect. We're going to make mistakes. For me, the magic is if, you know, we come back to these values, if you like, or principles, we are going to fall short, but we have to know what we have fallen short of. Otherwise, we get into trouble.
Absolutely.
Yeah, how true.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now you're teaching since such a long time. You've experienced so many situations as a CEO. And before that, you've been in legal as a lawyer in South Africa. So that's quite a tough journey itself. But now you're teaching really young leaders, still at Columbia, also with the MBA program of WHU. And they're sitting there, let's say 25 to 30 years. So what is, let's say, the key advice you give to those people in a nutshell?
Never stop learning. You know, I tell you, what we're all doing here in this great profession in education is teaching people lifelong learning. If learning is just an episode that you conduct during your degree program, and then you shut it off and say, well, I've learned now. It's the end of it. You're not going to succeed very well in life because things are changing constantly. We have to go on learning at the pace of change. And so that's what I like to encourage people. Keep a learning journal. It's a kind of very, very important way. What are the key insights that you've learned? What are their practical applications? Write them down in a learning journal. Review the learning journal regularly. Be lifelong learners. Now, let me tell you a little secret. I don't read many business books. I do read some, and I skim through a large number of them. I would say 75-80% of my reading is philosophy, evolutionary science, and astrophysics. And so much of my perspectives and insights about life come from learning from those three sources. I've mentioned a bit about philosophy. Evolutionary science, we both apply. This is the basis of a strategy methodology that enables us to adapt and obey the brutal rules, if you like, of evolutionary science, adapt or die. And astrophysics for me is an area of interest because books have now come out that are very easy for non-experts to understand. You know, I don't like looking at it through mathematical models. I don't follow an idea through a set of numbers and symbols. But a lot of very good books have come out that are easy to follow. A guy called Ray Bradbury, who is a science fiction writer, wrote a wonderful kind of summation about what we learned from astrophysics. And he said, we are born to witness the wonders of the universe and understand who we are, where we fit in, and what's important. Everything is transient in the universe. Impermanence is the rule. Our lives are transient as well. And I think what I learned from that is we have a very short time, but just enough time to make a difference. And for me, that's it. Mine will fly by. But what have we done in that little short period of time? You know, Bill Clinton tells this lovely story about how when he was president of the United States and had to confront a big decision, he called all these senior people into the Oval Office. And he said, here's the problem, let's discuss and solve it. And very soon there was backstabbing, siloed thinking, people undermining each other, et cetera, dysfunctional meeting. And he said, stop, this is a big problem. Stop, concentrate on the problem here and don't fight each other. And after 5 minutes, it became dysfunctional again. He wondered what he should do about that. And he was very creative. He called up NASA, the Space Administration people. And he said, you've been to the moon. Yes, sir, we have. Can you give me a moon rock? And they said, yes, and they delivered a moon rock. He said, not a two-ton thing, but I want a one I can put on the table in the middle of the Oval Office. So he put this moon rock in the middle of the table. It's literally true. He tells the story. And next time they had a meeting and it became dysfunctional because he didn't say a thing. The moon rock was sitting there. He didn't make an announcement, you know, in advance. When the meeting became dysfunctional, he said, stop. Do you see that rock? It's 3.5 billion years old. We just passing through for one brief moment, make a difference, solve the problem. He said it worked every time. It's a kind of nice little reminder of people. Got a short time, make a difference.
Absolutely great. Willie, thank you very, very much. And I think you made an enormous, big difference for me personally. 12 years ago, I've been with you in the classroom, and also for you, Jürgen, and our strategy frame. So thank you for making a difference.
Absolutely. Also, thank you from my side. It's inspirational, as always, listening to you. Fantastic. I'm looking forward to interacting with you next year in June when we come back to New York. Thank you so much.
Well, if you come back even before then, please do.
Yes.
I mean, I honestly say to you, and I've said it to you before, when you bring those fine young people over to New York, it's one of the highlights of my academic life.
Yeah, you did tell me already. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.